is Rhode Island's longest-running financial talk show, Money Talk with Don Soa. Taking care of business and working overtime. With market insights and so much more, talk to Don now at 437-5000 or 1-888-345-0790. This is Money Talk with Don Soa.
And welcome to Money Talk here on AM 790. This is not Don. This is Donna Soa Allard. I'm filling in for my dad tonight. Usually we are a team on Tuesdays doing the Back to Basics show. But when I got to the studio tonight, I looked at my dad and said, Dad, you need to go home. His dedication to you, the Money Talk listeners, is so intense that even when he's not feeling great, he shows up because he wants to put out a good show for you. But I said, what good is it to bring your kid into the business and share the airwaves with her if you can't take a night off when you don't feel well? So I'm hoping my dad feels much better for tomorrow. Tomorrow's Wednesday. So I hope he'll be back on the air for you on Thursday. But I'm happy to be here with you tonight. Today is Tuesday. It's the 21st of February. And once again, we saw that headline that the market closed at all-time highs. Well, remember, an all-time high just means it's 1 point higher than the previous close. But that is the case that all three indices, I believe, close at a high tonight. We saw the Dow Jones up almost 119. It was up 118.95. It closed up over 0.5% to 20,743. The S&P was up 14, just over 14 points, also a little over 0.5%. To close at 23.65, and the NASDAQ added just over 27 points, up almost 0.5% to close at 58.65. Why are we going up? Well, we have a couple things going on. Most of it, I believe, has to do with the fact that we saw some earnings come in today. We had both Home Depot and Walmart, our major retailers who posted, beat the experts' expectations. They beat the estimates. The leading sectors that we saw were energy and real estate. And, Home Depot's, they're better than estimate reports come in. That kind of correlates with your real estate numbers coming in high. So that's great. We also saw, on the political side of things, we saw the appointment of a new national security advisor, which is fantastic that that happened so quickly after Flynn's resignation. When we see government working efficiently, that makes the markets feel good, right? The markets don't like the idea of uncertainty. And so when we see the administration working efficiently and getting things done, that's always going to have that's going to result in buying and positive feelings, good consumer sentiment. So where are we? Let's see. It's Tuesday. So we are in the midst of tax season. And I know that because I have a good friend who's an accountant, and I basically just don't plan on hanging out with her during tax season. Now we're in February. So most of you should have received your W-2s and your 1099s and all of those tax documents that you're going to need to gather in order to get your taxes done. And so I thought, why not look up what are some of the common mistakes that people make at tax time so maybe I can help you avoid them. Now, as certified financial planner professionals, we certainly don't consider ourselves to be tax experts. We're not CPAs. I don't personally prepare taxes. But as part of our training in planning, we do have to cover a section on taxes. So we know enough about taxes and the way they work to know when we're making the right decisions within your portfolios regarding your investments and the effects that that can have on your taxes. We also know enough that when we're doing planning to say, oh, here's an area that maybe you should discuss with your accountant or you should seek some expert counsel in regarding your taxes. So I thought, let's look up what some of the most common mistakes are that the average person makes when you're doing your taxes, so maybe you can avoid them. And I think that it would surprise you. The first one that I found was, it seems so simple. It's the idea of math errors. Math errors are still the most common mistake made on tax returns. And you might say to yourself, well, how is that even possible? You just put everything into either some software or your tax preparer puts it into some software. But let's remember, even if all the calculations that you're making in the tax forms are correct, the information that you put in has to be right to begin with. Remember from the OJ trial, garbage in, garbage out? Well, make sure that the information you're putting in to do your taxes is correct. And you might say, well, how, if I'm going through my 1040 and I'm filling it all in, well, how could I be getting it wrong? Well, maybe you just start with the W-2 and you just have one line to fill in for your income. But many people, or I should say most people, have more than just one form when it comes to doing your taxes. You may have a W-2 from your employer. You may have a spouse with a W-2 from an employer. So, okay, that's fairly simple. But then do you also have any other sources of income? Do you have 1099s? Are you self-employed? Do you have a Schedule K-1 that then you have to transfer over to the 1040? Did you make sure that you got all the right information when it comes to deductions for your mortgage insurance? Did you make sure that you accounted for all the 1099s, maybe from distributions that you took from IRAs, or if you did a rollover? Do you have your 1099 dividend form from your brokerage account? There's a lot that goes into doing your taxes, and I just, you know, barely hit the tip of the iceberg on that one. But making sure that you have all of the proper information and that you're putting good information into your tax forms so that the math is done properly is really, really important. So I would say make sure you're not making math errors by putting the wrong information in. Here's another really, really simple one. Remember when you took your SATs in high school and they said you get points just for, you know, filling out your name on the test, you got 10 points for that or something like that? Well, apparently one of the most common mistakes in doing tax returns is either spelling a name incorrectly or there has been a name change that's not listed correctly. Well, remember, your name is associated with your Social Security number. You want to make sure that everything matches up properly. Identity theft is a really big deal. So if something doesn't match up properly, the IRS is hopefully going to pick up on it and make sure. So you want to make sure that you're putting the proper information in. If there has been a name change, make sure that it's properly listed there. Think of, you know, a marriage and maybe the wife is hyphenating a name. Make sure that's done properly. Make sure the paperwork has been done properly and make sure it's being recorded the same way on your tax return as it was on the documents when you did the name change. Same thing, you know, if you have a child, make sure that if there's a funky spelling of the child's name, which is more common than not, I would say these days, nothing is spelt the old-fashioned way anymore because everybody's original. Make sure that that's being, you know, written in there the correct way. A third common mistake is having the wrong Social Security number. This is a 9-digit number that identifies you. You want to make sure that your number's listed correctly and that your dependents' numbers are listed correctly so you don't have any, you know, unexpected problems there. Again, we want to make sure that everyone is identified properly. These are all really, you know, simple things. None of this has to do with, you know, high-level tax planning issues, right? All of this is really stuff that you, as the filer, can take care of yourself to double-check and make sure you have it correct. Next common one is making sure that you have the correct deposit information. What does that mean? Well, most people, if you're getting a tax return, the quickest way to get it is to have it deposited right into your checking account, right? Or a savings account or a brokerage account, whatever it is. Well, make sure that you have the right account number and routing number there, especially if you're doing multiple accounts, maybe parts going into savings, parts going into checking. I don't know. There's any number of ways it could happen. Make sure that you have the correct bank account or whatever type of account it is, the correct numbers and routing numbers on there. Another common one is, did you have a change in your filing status? Did you, you know, maybe you're divorced, but you're still filing as married, or maybe you've just gotten married. Maybe there's some planning reason why you're not doing married filing jointly. There's any number of reasons we run across. Sometimes a filing status that doesn't make the most mathematical sense makes sense for a couple because of a liability. There's any number of reasons, but you want to make sure that you and your partner are both putting the correct filing status in there. The IRS lists 5 filing status options for all taxpayers. They're single, married filing jointly, married filing separately. You could be head of household and qualifying widower with dependent child. So make sure that you have the proper one for you listed. If you're not sure what it should be, ask a tax advisor, ask a preparer. If you know, if you're going to H&R Block or something like that, ask someone. If you're using a TurboTax or, you know, one of the online softwares, usually they will have some sort of, you know, help tool that you can go to check out and make sure that you're choosing the status that is most appropriate for you. Because remember, it changes the tax brackets based on your income. You want to make sure that you're in the right tax bracket, getting the right deductions for you. So make sure that you are choosing the proper filing status. When we come back after this quick break, we're going to, I think we're on number 6 or so, look at our 6th common mistake for filing your taxes. We don't want to see you making any unnecessary mistakes. So stick around and join us when we come back here for more Money Talk on AM 790. And we're back here. Welcome to Money Talk on AM 790, your home for talking business. I'm Donna Soa Allard here doing the Back to Basics show. The Back to Basics show is something that my dad started back in 1991 when everybody didn't have access to the internet. It wasn't so easy to just go on and say, I don't even know if everybody had a computer in their house at that time for that matter. I think that was just kind of starting. You certainly couldn't go onto your cell phone and pull up your finance app to check on what was happening in your brokerage account or your IRA. It was a time when people, frankly, all of our listeners, relied on my dad and his show to tell you what's going on in the investment world. Everybody didn't necessarily utilize a 401k at work. Everyone didn't utilize an IRA on the side. People weren't so, you know, independent about their investing and, frankly, their financial planning. So it wasn't uncommon for, in the early years of the show, for people to call in with their last quarter's or last month's statement from their retirement plan and say, these are the choices in my plan. Can you tell me what this is? And is this something that's appropriate for me? Now it's different. Now most of our listeners can, you know, just go onto the computer or, check at work and say, you know, what's in my plan? How's it invested? Most people know what they have, but is it enough to know what you have? You have to know why you own it. So when I came to be on the air with my dad almost 3 years ago, we talked about it and said we should probably bring the Back to Basics show back. Let's bring back Back to Basics and make sure that everybody understands the fundamentals of planning issues and investing of financial products. We don't recommend products, but we want you to understand what they are. So if you have a mutual fund, you understand how it works, that a stock mutual fund is different than owning an individual stock, that owning a variable annuity and the subaccounts in there is different than just owning, you know, the same types of investments in a regular mutual fund. Understanding the kinds of questions that you should be asking when you work with your advisor. And I would say that probably is our number one goal, is not to, you know, teach you everything, but to have our listeners say, okay, the topic that you're talking about, that's relevant to me. That's going on in my life. And maybe this is something I should be talking about with my advisor at this time. Or this is relevant to me. Maybe I should go out and finally stop dragging my feet and get a financial advisor so that I can make sure that the decisions that I'm making make the most sense for me. Because remember, what you hear on the news, what you hear on the radio, even on shows like this, even though we're not selling you something, everything we're talking about isn't going to be right for you. So we just want to make sure that you understand what's out there and understand that there may be things that you should be seeking some counsel on or doing a little bit of research on your own if you're so inclined to, and really take ownership over your own financial situation and feel confident when you go in to talk with your advisor that you're able to, you know, ask smart questions and that you understand the terminology. But also, if you don't understand something your financial advisor is talking about, feel confident in saying, I need you to explain that a little bit more. I would never want someone that I'm working with to sit in front of me and listen to me talk. And remember, the vocabulary that we use, it's stuff that we talk about every day, day in, day out. We're used to it. So we need to be reminded if you're not used to it. So, you know, please, if you're working with an advisor or any professional in any field for that matter, as the client, as the consumer, if you're paying for that advice, make sure that you understand it and that, you know, your advisor is speaking to you at your level and meeting you where you are. So before we went to the first break, we were talking about some of the common tax mistakes or common mistakes that people make when they are doing their tax returns. We want to help you avoid some of these most common, very simple mistakes. We'll leave the complicated stuff to your tax preparer or your accountant, but the ones that we're talking about are fairly simple, and they're stuff that if you just do, you know, kind of double check, you can make sure they're the correct yourself. We are on, where were we? Were we on number six of eight that I've prepared for you today? Number six is about charitable contributions. You can deduct your charitable contributions if you itemize your taxes. So if you've donated some cash or if you've donated gifts to charities, to 501c3s, those are nonprofit organizations, or maybe you're like me, you know, I moved 3 years ago and we're still going through boxes and I'm finding some stuff that I've moved I can donate. I'm actually doing one of those things. I found it online. I think it's a 40 bags in 40 days kind of thing where you go through and declutter to organize your life and you end up with a bag from one area of your house every time. Some stuff needs to be thrown out, but inevitably there's going to be some stuff that's good to donate. Every time you go to Savers or Goodwill, they will ask you, would you like a slip to take a tax deduction? Your answer should be yes, I will take that slip. You know, obviously, unless you're in a rush sometimes, I suppose you might pass that by. But make sure you're documenting all your gifts. So if you belong to, you know, a church or some parish, you donate weekly there, if you're dropping $10 or $20 in the basket every time the basket goes by, there's no record of that. But if you give online or if you're putting in you know, that envelope that has your name and your, I don't know, family identification number and the amount you're putting in, at the end of the year, they will send you a record of your donations because you can deduct that from your taxes. If you make a donation to, you know, a private school, whether it be a university that's your alma mater, a high school that you went to, you can deduct that contribution. Now, you can't deduct the tuition. That doesn't count. You're paying tuition for an education. But if you're making, you know, a donation to the school because they have either a PTA organization that accepts cash donations, or if they have, you know, some sort of, you know, general fund, they have an endowment that you make a contribution to, you can deduct that. You can deduct, you know, actual gifts. If you donate art to a nonprofit and they're putting it on the wall, you can deduct the fair market value of that. If you donate a car, I know that there's lots of advertisements out there for, I think the one I see all the time is cars for the blind. I assume it's not for them to be driving, but it's for people to drive them. So if you want to do that instead of trading in your old car, you can do that and take a deduction for that. Make sure that you're keeping records of all this because I realize that when you're doing your taxes, you just write in the number. So you add up all of the math and write in the number and you can deduct that. But you want to make sure that you keep records of everything, that you're doing the math properly so that if you do ever get audited, you can go in and show them actual receipts for those deductions. So it's not just an Excel spreadsheet that you keep yourself, but it's actual receipts from the organization. So make sure that you get the value correct on there and make sure that you do take that deduction. Another common mistake, and this is going to seem as obvious to you as spelling your name properly is, but signing and dating the return. Once you get through preparing your tax return, whether you do it yourself or you do it through a preparer, it cannot be filed until it has been signed and dated by the taxpayer or payers. So if you are married filing jointly, make sure that both spouses are signing and dating on the bottom line. Don't send it in if just one of you has signed. You both have to do it and you both have to date it. So make sure that gets done. And then Lastly, don't be late, right? Make sure you get it in on time. The traditional deadline is April 15th. If it falls on a weekend, you get the Monday. If it falls on a Monday and the Monday's a holiday, then they push it to the next day, which we've seen a lot in recent years. But make sure that you get it done. If you're filing an extension, make sure you file for the extension on time. But even if you're filing for an extension, that's just giving you more time to get all that paperwork done. If you owe taxes, you need to make sure that it is paid by that deadline. So make sure that you're getting it done. I believe that this year, certainly there's a, I know there's a federal holiday in DC, so I believe it's April 18th is the deadline. Make sure that even if you're filing an extension, taxes are paid. Make sure if you're not filing for an extension that you've got all of your paperwork in on time, you've double-checked everything, your I's are dotted, your T's are crossed. Don't be last minute getting things into your accountant, because remember, if everybody's last minute, your accountant or tax preparer can't possibly do everybody's 2 days before the deadline. So you've got time now, gather your documents, get things done, get it into your preparer, and make sure that you're, don't, you know, shoot yourself in the foot by making silly mistakes that you could avoid by just going through and making sure, again, that your I's are dotted and your T's are crossed. And I'm getting the sign that we're coming up on halftime here on Money Talk. So we're going to go to a quick break, and I hope you'll join us back here after the break for more Money Talk. We're going to be talking about financial concerns of different generations, and then also mistakes that you can make with an inherited IRA. So please join us back for more Money Talk after this. And welcome back to the second half of the Money Talk show here on AM 790, your home for talking business. I'm Donna Soa Allard, here doing the Back to Basics show on Tuesday, typically. If you listen in, you'd hear me doing this show with my dad, but I'm filling in for him tonight. For the next topic we're going to cover here has to do with the top financial concerns of different generations. And I'm pulling the information from a survey that was done by PricewaterhouseCoopers last year. They published it in April of 2016, so it's almost just a year ago. It was called their Employee Financial Wellness Survey. So they did this survey, I think it had about 50,000 participants, and drew from it, you know, some conclusions based on the breaking the participants down by generation. And for their purposes, they defined generations a little bit differently than the U.S. Census Bureau does. So, like, I'm noticing 1 year that's a little bit different. They define baby boomers as being born between 1943 and 1960, Gen X being 1961 to 1981, and millennials as 1982 to 97. Sometimes we see millennials starting at 1980 or 1981, so they pushed it out a little bit farther. But 1 year doesn't really make a whole lot of difference, right? So they started off, and I welcome you to call into the show and chime in on this if you want. They wanted, the number here is, the local number is 437-5000. And if you're calling out of state, it's 888-345-0790. My question would be, you know, what is your biggest financial concern or your top financial concern? When they got through this, you know, according to the study, 38% of baby boomers, 46% of Gen Xers, and 51% of millennials said specifically that finance is the, or financial matters are the top cause for stress in their life. So what might other some causes for stress be? Well, it could be family, marriage, health. There are any other number of possibilities, but many, specifically younger ones. So that's pretty interesting if you think about it, because boomers are approaching retirement, but they are less concerned about their finances than the Gen Xers who are kind of in it, right? Your Gen Xers are in your late 30s up to, you know, 50s. And then millennials, more than half of millennials as defined by this survey, are consider money to be their top concern. So the younger you are, the more concerned you are about money at this point. And in fact, half of baby boomers, 56% of Gen Xers and 60% of millennials all share the same top financial concern, which is, and now you'd think it might be retirement, specifically saying that, you know, baby boomers, 50% of them list this as their top concern. It's not retirement. It's not retirement. It is their emergency savings. Their top concern is about not having enough emergency savings for unexpected expenses. That's pretty big. I mean, if I think about it in financial planning, that's where we start. We start with budgeting and say, you know, before you can pay off all of your debt, before you can, you know, effectively save for retirement or, you know, start saving for your kids' education, you want to make sure that you are not at risk and build some emergency savings. So that is the top concern across the board by half or more of all participants. So if we break this down by generation, starting with boomers, they do cite retirement as being one of the top concerns. 45% reportedly said that they do worry about not being able to retire when they want to, though 79% of this group said that they are currently saving for retirement, and 52% believe they will have to delay. So think about that. You've got 79% of baby boomers saving for retirement. Baby boomers are, they are staring retirement in the face right now, right? They're either just retiring or starting to look at retirement. So 79% are saving for retirement. More than half believe that they will have to delay retiring more, you know, farther out than they were hoping to. And I mean, that makes a lot of sense when you consider that, you know, report after report shows that, you know, as a society, we're undersaving. You know, the majority of people have less than $50,000 saved for retirement. You know, this is in addition to income they expect to receive from Social Security and pensions. So that makes a lot of sense. More than half expect that they will have to delay. They're a little bit ambiguous about what delay means. I mean, if my hope is to retire at 62, but I have to wait until my full retirement age of 67, well, yes, I mean, technically that's delaying retirement longer than I'd hoped to, but is that, you know, something really unreasonable? No, probably not really, considering how long my retirement's probably going to last, right? Health issues accounted for 30, or healthcare costs accounted for 38%. Of people's top concern. So think about it. If your health is not well, right? If you're not in great shape, if you're unhealthy, if you have a lot of healthcare costs, well, that certainly jeopardizes this, you know, I would say the success of your retirement plan, because if you're shelling out a lot of money for healthcare costs, which have a higher rate of inflation on them than, you know, your other general expenses, that's really going to eat into your retirement savings. That's really going to eat into the spending power of your Social Security income. So that makes a lot of sense. Other reasons reported by baby boomers for delaying retirement besides those healthcare costs are just, quite frankly, not having enough money saved for retirement, having too much debt, and some, 27%, reported not wanting to retire. To some people, that sounds absolutely crazy, and I understand why it would. So many people are looking at retirement as the goal, but a lot of people love what they do. And, you know, if it's not physically taxing on you, if you're in good health, say, hey, I want to keep working. I don't want to get pushed out. How about Gen X? So while your baby boomers are really concerned about retiring when they want to, Gen X, they're more specifically worried just about running out of money in retirement, with 50% of the surveyed group citing it as their top concern. More Gen Xers than baby boomers, well, not much more, 26% versus 25%, have already withdrawn money held in their retirement plans to pay for expenses other than retirement. Wow, think about that. So if they're not doing it under, you know, from their IRA or 401k under one of the allowable reasons, there are some reasons, either hardship withdrawals specifically for education, or if you want to take, you know, a 401k loan to pay, to put a down payment on a house, those are all with, you know, either loans or withdrawals. Other than that, you're paying a 10% penalty on top of ordinary income taxes if it's an early withdrawal. that's not even accounting for the loss of growth over time because you've taken money out of there. Your retirement money is for retirement. So yeah, if they're doing that, that is a concern. That is a huge concern. Besides worrying about retirement, 25% of Gen Xers are concerned about just generally meeting their monthly expenses. So we're not talking about retirement expenses, we're talking about expenses today. 44% find it difficult to meet their regular household expenses on time each month, and 53% consistently carry balances on credit cards. So that means living outside of your means. For Gen Xers, so again, this group that's in their late 30s, 40s, and 50s, being laid off from work is another huge financial worry. This was cited by almost a quarter, by 22% of those surveyed. That was more of a concern for the Gen X group than it was for baby boomers or for millennials. So job security, being laid off, is a huge concern for this group. Millennials, on the other hand, are more concerned about meeting, well, all I should say also concerned about meeting current expenses. This concern has grown substantially for them from 23% in the same survey a year prior up to 35% in 2016. They're also finding it, harder to pay household expenses on time each month. Considering the amount of debt that this age group has from student loans, that's really not surprising to me. It's reported that 42% have student loans, with 79% of millennials saying that their student loans have a moderate or significant impact on their ability to meet other financial goals. This is a huge concern, for the financial planning industry. How do we help this group pay down that debt in an effective way, help them find the most efficient ways to pay down that debt so that they can start thinking about other financial goals? You know, I saw an article that cited retirement as the biggest expense you will ever have, bigger than saving for college, bigger than, buying a house. The retirement is the largest expense you'll ever have. I saw it reported by one survey that it will roughly cost you $700,000. So if you don't have that in savings, you're getting some of it from, obviously, from your Social Security. But this is a very, very large expense. So if in the early years, when you could be socking money away, you're putting it all into paying down your college debt, yeah, that is a concern. That's a huge concern. So when we come back from this next break, we're going to briefly address, how the generations might address these financial concerns. And we're also going to talk briefly about, mistakes with inherited IRAs. So hopefully you don't make them, because they are costly and can be irreversible. So don't touch that dial. Join us for the fourth portion of Money Talk when we come back. Welcome back to Money Talk here on AM 790, your home of talk and business. I'm Donna Soa Allard, certified financial planner professional and co-host of Tuesday's Back to Basics show. We're here in the fourth quarter of the show. Fourth quarter is when the Patriots win Super Bowls, and it's when I'm going to help you win by not making mistakes if you inherit an IRA. What do I mean by an inherited IRA? This is if you're a non-spousal beneficiary, meaning you inherited an IRA from a parent, a grandparent, an aunt or uncle, or just a good friend who you had a good relationship with and they decided to make you their beneficiary. That's an inherited IRA. If your spouse passes away, well, that's different. When you have a spousal IRA, you can roll it into your own, and then the rules of your own IRA are what apply, right? But that's different. When it comes to an inherited IRA, there are different rules. And I'm going to I picked out a few that I think are, common mistakes people make. Mistakes are expensive when we're talking about tax-deferred money. You don't want to pay unnecessary penalties, and you don't want to be hit with a tax bill that you are not expecting. So let's start right off the bat with required distributions. Owners of traditional IRAs, so these are tax-deferred IRAs, if you are the owner, you have to start taking required minimum distributions when you turn 70 and a half. Non-spouse beneficiaries of any age, if you want to stretch out their IRA over your life expectancy, you have to start taking the required minimum distributions in the year following. Well, all right, let's, I'll say this, try to say this very clearly. The year following the year the owner passed away. So if the owner passed away in November of 2016 and you inherited the IRA, you now have to start taking your required minimum distribution based on your age in 2017. Okay? So why does it matter? Why do you want to do this? Well, because if you don't start taking it in that year, instead, you're going to have to take, if you don't make the decision, at least by the end of that year, you're going to have to take it all out within the following year, and you don't want to get hit with that tax bill. If you are in, what if it's a huge IRA? What if it's, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars? That's going to change everything about your taxes if you suddenly have to take it in that year, right? So if you want to stretch it, you want to get the most tax-deferred growth possible, by stretching it over your life expectancy and adding the least amount onto your tax bill in each year, because remember, you have to pay taxes on those distributions. You want to make sure that you take your first distribution in the year following the death of the owner. And remember, even though Roth IRA owners don't have to take a required minimum distribution, a non-spouse beneficiary does have to take the distribution. You don't have to pay taxes on the distribution, but you do have to take it out. If you fail, that's from a Roth. If you fail to take the RMD as you're supposed to, the penalty, remember, is 50% of the amount that should have been withdrawn that year. So it's a 50% penalty and ordinary income taxes if it's a traditional IRA. If you miss an RMD, it's possible to avoid the penalty by taking the account out within 5 years from the owner's death. However, depending on the size of the IRA, you know, that could still be a sizable amount on your tax return. So you want to make sure that you watch that. If the account owner died after they started taking RMDs, but had not yet taken it for the year in which they died, the non-spouse beneficiary must also take that RMD. So this is one of those cases when it really pays to work with an advisor, make sure that they're helping you through the rules on this so that you don't make an expensive mistake. Another thing is to make sure that you title the account properly. Non-spouse beneficiaries cannot roll an inherited IRA into their own IRA. You can't do that. Only spouses can do that. Instead, you have to set up a separate account with a title that includes the decedent's name and the fact that the account is for a beneficiary. So an example of this could be a Stephen Smith IRA for the benefit of Jane Doe. If the account is split among beneficiaries, then each new IRA has to be properly titled. You also want to make sure that the IRA is divided among the beneficiaries. So make sure that all the beneficiaries know that the IRA is being divided, especially if there's a wide age difference, because each beneficiary is going to have their own RMD calculation. So if you're older, then you would have to take out, you want to stretch the IRA out, your distribution is going to be higher than someone who's younger. So think about it. If there's, you know, five kids in a family and they're each 20% beneficiaries, if someone's 15 years older than the youngest, you know, if your oldest is 15 years older than the youngest, they're going to have different required minimum distributions. So make sure that, you know, everybody, you split it into the proper beneficiary IRAs or inherited IRAs. Here's an odd one. You don't want to ignore non-person beneficiaries. So what could that mean? Well, if you have a charity as a beneficiary, which you do see, or a trust, you want to make sure that that they are paid out within the proper time frame. If a trust is a beneficiary, you know, you have to send a copy of the trust to the custodian by October 31st of the year following the owner's death. Otherwise, it's considered a non-designated beneficiary in the same, there's, you know, special payout rules for it. So you want to make sure that if there are non-spousal beneficiaries, you're working with an advisor to plan out the best distribution option for you so that you don't get hit with a huge tax bill, and so that you take advantage of the option of stretching out that tax-deferred growth as long as possible if that's your goal. So I hope this has been helpful for you. I've tried to provide some timely tips between, your simple tax mistakes that you can avoid and not making mistakes on your non-spouse inherited IRAs. This has been Money Talk here on Tuesday. It was the Back to Basics show. I'm Donna Soa Allard. I was very happy to be here with you tonight. Tune into AM 790 tomorrow night at 5 for Steve Bove. He'll be here with Nathan. So thanks for joining us. Have a good night.